this talk, or really a sort of slightly random collection of maps and graphs, is to get something off my chest. And I'm not going to answer the question about whether we're biased or not, I'm afraid. I just have a suspicion that we have been becoming more biased over time, those of us who work in the UK. And this applies to whether you were brought up in the UK or whether you come as a researcher from somewhere else. I think we tend to adapt to the circumstances that we find ourselves in very quickly as human beings. Work on longitudinal studies has shown how quickly somebody can become happy again after terrible events happen to them. We know we adapt. And I worry it has an effect on our studies and what we actually do. I think I was asked almost a year ago to do this, and at the time there was one particular study about how children in the millennium cohort were being brought up and whether their parents were bringing them up, reading to them and doing other middle class kind of things. And they were doing very well at age 5 or 6, and I just thought, if you were a normal European, you'll be thinking, what on earth are you doing worrying about how a child does at age 5 and 6, because they won't go to school until later. But our model of what a good education is what we've become used to. And I think one great danger is that you can think that you're not affected by this. You can label yourself as quite a liberal, quite broad-minded. In fact, you might say I'm very left-wing, which is what's normal in academia. But actually, over time, you yourself have moved and become more conservative without realising it because of the nature of the country you're in, and it changes the questions. That's my kind of suggestion. I'm not going to give too many examples because it's a bit pernicious and I could get done for libel if I do too many. I'll come on to this one in a minute. One thing that made me think of this is a report by the House of Commons Library about inequality in Europe, where there's a graph which I haven't got for you, showing Gini coefficients of all the OECD countries. And above the graph it says, the UK is one of the most unequal countries in Europe, but not as unequal as the USA. And then when you look at the graph, you actually see the UK is more unequal than all the other countries in Europe, and the USA is truly abysmal. But the civil servant working in the House of Commons Library has to write things in a way which is seen as politically neutral. And politically neutral in this country has moved to the right. These two bars are from the kind of graphs that ONS do nowadays, which are heading towards the standard BBC graph, which is either one bar or two bars. ONS on January the 10th announced that inequality had fallen, income inequality, by looking at equivalised household incomes of the median of the bottom quintile and top quintile of households. In other words, they ignored the top 10% of households. And this is what they do routinely. But they no longer even bother to explain they're doing that, which I think is part of this shift. It's a little like studying ill health or life expectancy and ignoring the most frail 10% of the population. And if you're interested in inequality, why would you leave out 10%? Well, they do it because they think they've got good quality data on the 10th percentile and the 90th percentile person. But there were other aspects of this story. I wrote it up in a conversation. It's not just that we're ignoring the top 10% and think that inequality has fallen. The average person, the median's got worse, but we ignored that. The bottom fifth, who appear to have done better in Britain of households, have only done better because more are in work. It's not actually the pensioners. More are in work because people are forced to take jobs in this country more than, as far as I can tell, almost any other country in Western Europe. 1 million people were sanctioned in 2013. Is it necessarily an achievement if you've got people in work and their households are fractionally better off? I think by about £13 a week, but they have to go and do a job. And ONS presents this as wonderful. And there's the graphs that you can see. A graph saying things are getting better, when if you look at it another way, which you can't see on the graphs, and you look at how the top 1% has moved away, how the top half of the 10% is doing okay, what is actually happening to people's lives at the bottom. Oh, and all of this completely ignores the cost of housing over time. The number of people who are renting have doubled between the last two censuses. The amount you have to pay in rent has gone much higher. If you're in the top 10% by income, you might own your house outright, or you might be in the last 10 years of a mortgage, and interest rates have never been lower. All of that's ignored. I can go on and on, as you can tell. I'll try not to. So my suggestion is that since I was a child, our politics has moved step to the right. One example of this is that the UK Conservative Party now belongs to a strange group of extreme right-wing parties in Europe. New Labour, when it was created, became very right-wing for a supposed left-wing party. We had big cuts, 79, 80, 81, to what was OPCS. We had big cuts after 2010 to ONS. Creates a different atmosphere for our government's statistical agencies. It's not just they can do less, there's also an implicit threat. And we've had these incredible increases in inequality, which cannot not have had an effect on us. So two people who are university researchers, not very high up the grades, will be in the top 10% of household by income, but will feel very badly off, as will two relatively young full professors in London who find they can't buy a house or a flat in Royal Holloway, and so on. It's all a mess, but it affects our daily lives. There's some text which I won't read out. It's just about the biggest update of Obamacare, because I'm now going to go through some stuff about Trump and correlates with health. And I am going to get to one slide with understanding society data, but very, very simple data. Nothing complicated. The irony about Obamacare is the biggest increase in uptake of it was in those states which voted in Trump after they voted in Trump. Here's a weird map. That's a cartogram of the United States. The little map at the bottom is showing Obama's last victory. Things are the other way around in the states. So the Democrats get blue, the Republicans get red. There is slightly more blue there. Obama did win. Here's the Trump victory. Trump is red, because again, the Americans, if you're hegemonic power in the world, you're allowed to do things the other way around to everybody else. The British used to do that. So the majority of the map isn't red. As you know, Trump got fewer votes than the Democrats, but more importantly, Trump didn't win in areas with lots of children. Didn't win in areas where there are many people who are not registered to vote. Why did Trump win? The best correlate that The Economist magazine could find, and they looked at about 40, to look at geographical explanations of which counties moved slightly to the Republicans. Essentially, it was just another Republican vote, but it was a slight shift. And the best correlate was with an index of poor health. So it's people living in areas where the health had got worse. Not necessarily the individuals with poor health, because other surveys suggest that Trump supporters are generally a bit better off, apart from being much more likely to be white and a bit old. But people like that in places that were going downhill, absolutely in the States, because we've got life expectancy falls now in counties. The reason for showing this is to talk about what's happening in Britain, because I think it's similar, and I could be wrong. There's our Brexit geography. Both of these votes, by the way, are very marginal. You know, 2 or 3% could have been a completely different story. I don't think it would have been a different story if it had been 2 or 3% the other way. I think if Remain had won by 2%, we'll be heading towards another referendum now, because the group who wanted the referendum would have had to carry on getting the funding they needed to keep on agitating, and the Tory party would carry on being split. The map isn't as obvious as the US map, doesn't correlate as well with ill health, but this is the thing I want to show you, because this bugs me, and this is understanding society. And this is where I may have made a mistake, but I can't find any evidence that I've made a mistake. These four graphs are showing the proportions of people in understanding society since 2009 who say they're completely satisfied with their health, somewhat satisfied with their health, mostly dissatisfied or completely dissatisfied. And what you can see there is 2009 and 10, you have about, if I can read it, 6% of people mostly dissatisfied, and then that suddenly doubles. Now, normally when you see that, it's a good place to show this, at least for me, if not for you. Normally when the proportion of people who say that their health is bad doubles, somebody's changed the survey, or changed the question, or mucked up the coding on the output, and this is actually the answer to another question. And that's possible, but I can't find any evidence that that's happened. This isn't my analysis of understanding society. This is ONS's analysis, because these four questions are used in David Cameron's Happiness Index. The Happiness Index, which was constructed in 2010, and which nobody checked afterwards. They just published it every year and we all ignored it. And this is, anybody here want to tell me they actually ever checked what's happening to our happiness? Okay, it had about 30 things in it, but the most important thing in it, as far as I'm concerned, is the health question, because health is the most important thing to your personal happiness, which you learn as you get older, even if you don't learn from doing research. You suddenly had the population say that they were getting much less healthy. We had some small increases in deaths amongst elderly people, particularly elderly women, who are more likely to live alone, which I think is the main reason why it's women, in 2012 and 2013. And social cuts, halved the number of social work visits, Meals on Wheels stopped turning up and so on. But it was small. 2015, we got this absolutely enormous increase in mortality. About 52,000 more deaths than normal. That's showing you the absolute rises by age. Mid-year to mid-year, I think it's the largest increase since 1940. I'd say I think, because ONS will charge me for mid-year to mid-year data before 92, and I'm damned if I'm going to give them any money to tell me something which ought to be in the public domain. Down this side, if you've got very good eyesight, you can see the calendar year to calendar year changes in mortality rates. And there are 2 years, 1951 and 1968, by calendar year, which since the Second World War have had a slightly bigger increase in mortality, but they were actual flu pandemic years. There was no flu pandemic in 2015. Only a minority of the people who died had flu, as far as we can tell. It was Alzheimer's and dementia. These were frail people who were not being well cared for. All the early dates, by the way, for other big events are 1918, 1846, which was cholera, 1895, which was a very cold winter, 1940, which was the bombing and the soldiers coming back who were injured and so on. So a really dramatic thing happened in 2015. And I think one reason that we've just let it happen with very little comment is that we've become acclimatized to a harsher country. And I think that's one reason why in the US it can get to the point of absolute rises in infant mortality in many areas and so on without great shock. And it worries me for our studies. I was writing a chapter on economic geography about a year ago, And I suddenly realised that the majority of papers on economic geography are written by US or British geographers, mainly because geography is really pretty constrained as an international subject. And people are writing things about how equilibrium works and the market will all sort it out and so on. And I was thinking, this is actually telling me more about people who live in the UK and USA than it tells me about economic geography, because you have a collective group thing. There's the relative increases in mortality. So this is mid-year, June 2013 to 2014, compared to 2014-2015. The younger ages, of course, are less important, other than to say that big drop is 25 to 29-year-olds, which is the one age group which had a 60,000 net immigration in that just that year. Immigrants are very healthy. That almost linear increase in relative chances of dying, 12% increase in the number of people dying over 90, suggests to me frailty. It's the frail. It's people who were less likely to make it another year or another 2 years when various things didn't happen, when you turn up on a trolley and have to wait 10 hours. The person who's more likely to die is the person who's more frail. But there hasn't been that many studies of this event, and that sort. There have been statements like this. This is Michael Marmot's statement. It is government policy to increase inequality, to make things harder for families with children. That will have an adverse impact on the health of the children, the health of those children when they become adults, and the health of the parents who are trying to make ends meet. So people do say things. We've kind of become used to it. I'm going to show you the most, and then I'll show you the most recent. And here's one of these very crude comparisons of inequality versus infant mortality. I'll show you more detailed on in a minute. We have highest rate of children dying under five in Europe, apart from, is it Malta and Romania? But we're kind of used to that now. Here's a more sophisticated one. I've got one you can really criticise me for, but the far one away from me, every US state is shown in this little circle. So if you treat each US state as a country, and then it's 20 countries where we got information about how much the best off 1% have. Each circle's the size of the population of the country, and then the infant mortality rate, I think in 2014, is on the y-axis. The higher inequality, the more the 1% take, the more babies die. It's actually the 1% take in 1983, but these things tend to be correlated over time. So I'm not saying it's causal, just saying these things are very closely related to each other. And we are, the UK, England and Wales at least, is very like a United States state in terms of inequality. In fact, so like a US state that President Trump might invite us to become the 51st one when we have our special trade deal, which essentially is, you're in. This thing really is very naughty. I don't know if it's naughty. I really would love you to tell me if it's naughty. It's the same thing. So the nearer to me a dot, the more that the top 1% got in the 1980s. But the height, it's the proportion of people voting right, far right at the last election. My definition of far right being what the New York Times called far right in an article it did for Europe, and Republican in the last election, which might annoy some Americans, but given what was being said, I don't think it was very different to what European far right parties say. Two outliers are perhaps understandable. That's Germany. More people should vote right, far right in Germany. For some historical reason, they don't. And that's France. There's slightly more people vote far right than you'd expect. Maybe I shouldn't draw graphs like that. I haven't published that one yet. Just looking at these things. Here's what's happened most recently. I showed this graph in December. And it's looking at the weekly deaths. 2016 has been almost as bad as 2015 was. If you look at the weekly deaths, because they get reported about 3 week lag from ONS, 22,000 more people died in 2016 than the average for the preceding 5 years, including that worst year since 1940. More people died every week apart from 9 weeks. It's absolutely spread over. It's as if we have a general health and social care crisis. That's right. Okay, no, it doesn't seem. But you've got to, and I think this affects our research, you know, we criticise, but it affects, people don't listen. I've been looking at this for a few years, so I think I'm immune to it and don't get that upset about it. As far as I know, we've got four chief medical officers, one for each country. None of them have said anything about this. Directors of Public Health are just looking at it. Public Health England produced a report saying they thought it was flu, essentially, which we know now it isn't flu. The Department of Health, apart from telling GPs they should be working for 12 hours a day, you know, but it's very, very odd. At some point, by the way, this has to stop. It stopped in 2014 slightly, because when you've got a really high rate, accelerated rate of death amongst the very elderly and frail, you run out of the very elderly and frail. It's a culling effect. So we should expect at some point there to be a drop. The shares of the major undertaking firms in Britain doubled in 2015, which is a bit silly because there's a finite number of people who can die if you're an undertaker. Okay, away from the depressing thing, I'm showing that. A sort of more hippie or happier thing. And again, I don't know whether it's helpful showing these, because it's not saying that one causes the other. This is again inequality on the x-axis. Again, it's a share of the 1%, how much income the top 1% get. All inequality measures, Gini ratio, share of the 1%, fortunately now correlate with each other very nicely for countries. So didn't used to. Share of the 1% is my favourite one, because it's relatively easy to see what you need to do if you want to reduce that one. Right, it's only the best off 1% of people. You don't want them taking as much money. Sounds quite easy, but it obviously affects everybody directly below them, because if they have as much as they used to have, they would then jump into the 1%. On the y-axis there, you've got the proportion of people who are cycling or walking to work. And the suggestion, obviously, is that countries that somehow manage to constrain their very greedy people also manage to plan things like public transport and roads and housing so that you're near to where you work, so that you can walk or cycle to work. I think that's the implication of that. You can't prove it. This is very different from looking at 40,000 people in a longitudinal study and producing some regressions, where in fact, of course, the results depend on what you decide to include as much as your techniques. Okay, back to my worry about that report I saw on which children do well in the millennium cohort on education. Here's a pretty random sort of set of these circles. Again, we've got an inequality measure on the side, and on the x-axis, and on the y-axis, we've got the PISA score for 15 to 16 year olds in maths. Get about the same thing for problem solving, same thing for literacy. But in general, the more equitable countries, children tend to do better at age 15 or 16. The more unequitable ones, the UK and the United States, do a bit worse. Singapore's just being annoying. Now here's the interesting thing, this will be partly due to luck. Actually, it has to be. Not very statistical. When I look at that, I think it's partly lining up so well out of chance. I don't look at hundreds of these kind of graphs, because I now have children, I don't have enough time. So this isn't completely fixed, but you see they're all suddenly lining up much more. This is PISA 2012 data, but it's up to age 24. People being tested the same maths test, but later on. And the UK and the USA are absolutely appalling. And it's much neater. Now, okay, there's a bit of chance in here. In PISA 2015, latest one, they didn't include this stats. We can't check it again, which is a pity, because I do worry about it jumping around randomly. But the suggestion is that whatever we've been doing in the US and UK, it kind of gets you results that sort of look okay at 15, 16, but when you test somebody a few years later with the same maths questions, they do much worse. And my gut anecdote feeling is that this is because we are teaching children to get an A or an A star, not to actually enjoy maths, or teaching other children to get a C rather than a D, which is the be all and end all for the bottom third of schools in Britain. And none of it results in people actually being happy and enjoying maths. But if we include getting a high score at GCSE as a good outcome in a study where we're looking at cohort effects on children and whether their parents read to them, and whether they go out to play, and whether they play with dirt or whatever, if we see that as good, then we end up producing reports which are actually aimed at producing a country that's like this, that isn't very good, if you see what I mean. Because we ourselves have been conditioned, I'm conditioned, to want my children to get as many A's and B's and hopefully C's, and minimise the number of D's and E's at the GCSE. I'm part of the collective paranoia about that. And I think it has an effect on us. The effect is likely to be large, but you can't, when you're in the middle of this thing, you can't judge it. So I haven't got an answer about how biased we are, but it worries me. Let me give you another dozen or so slides. It's a slightly more political, and then please think of a question. So probably about another 10 minutes. It's just about the oddness. You know, we've got these studies and these birth cohort studies in a country that has become exceedingly odd. This is IMF data showing that we're on course to be the lowest public spender of all these countries apart from Ireland and the USA. A slightly more laissez-faire left-wing country like Finland or France will be spending over 50% of its GDP on public services. But we spend incredibly little. We spend relatively highly on our armed services, which isn't normal in Europe. So the Americans are not complaining about us not contributing to NATO. Obviously, the more you spend on your armed services, the less you're spending on other public services. It's a strange place, but we write about our studies as if it's a normal place. Wealth data is almost impossible. Well, not completely impossible to get. This was data released by ONS, who then retracted it on the grounds that they probably underestimated the wealth of the 1%. But we've got the Sunday Times Rich List, which let's just check that. We've got a vote coming up in France, fairly important vote. France is very, very different from the UK and the USA on these kind of things I look at. So if these things are related, the French shouldn't vote majority for Marine Le Pen, but that's not much of a prediction. If the French do vote majority Marine Le Pen, one upside is you can stop having this paranoia I've got that we're that weird. It's not much of a great thing to happen, but we'll see. I have another cartoon like this, but not yet made so nice, which is a very steep slope. A bit like one of those things that skiers go down just before they shoot off into the air. So it gets higher and higher as you go up. And it shows people at the top clinging on, but looking very scared when they look down, and people at the bottom are absolutely grovelling at the bottom because it's a long way down. That's what an unequal country looks like. Inequalities get bigger and wider the further up you go. So the inequalities between vice chancellor's pay is far higher than the inequalities between universities' cleaners' pay. Nobody ever says, poor vice chancellor. For all those vice chancellors who are paid below the average for vice chancellors. But I sometimes think you should. Than a spare small feeling for them. But it just gets bigger and harder. In a more equitable country, the slope looks like this. There's always a slope. And in these more equitable countries, you have much higher rates of social mobility because people don't worry about their children moving up and down the slope as much. That's Matthew Elliott. We think that our research isn't that affected by politics. Matthew Elliott was the chief executive of the Leave campaign. His deputy was Dominic Cummings. Dominic Cummings was the chief SPAD in the Department of Education with Michael Gove. Department of Education, but also ESRC, have chosen to carry on funding cohort and large sample studies, but not other kinds of social science. I think partly because they think that they will confirm what they think is true is true. But that's connected. UK voting patterns are as divided as the United States. So the colourful cartogram is showing the proportion of people voting Conservative. In the purple areas it gets to over 50% of those who vote. In the dark red areas it's less than 5%. Incredible range. If you work out a segregation index for Conservative voters, the basic segregation index, it's now just surpassed its maxima. That's maxima, which is the 1918 election. So we're more segregated by voting geographically than we've been since 1832. So really divided, really unequal country in many ways. That was George Osborne's last budget, which you may spot. We've just got used to it. Budgets give more to the best off 10th than the next 10th to the next 10th. And this is my worry. I'm sure I've iterated enough times to you now. I'm worried that we've gone through so many years and decades of this that it changes how we study and look at things because we take it for granted that this is how the world is. If we were a normal European country, we would be taxing people at a normal European level, which is much higher. We spend on education and health normally. The rest of the mainland doesn't have our segregated independent schools and anything like this then that we do. We'd have normal housing laws that gave tenants some decent rights. Basic income's becoming fashionable. For young people, and it's interesting how there are now children being born into understanding society. So we'll at least be able to study these young people in a different way. We've got two forms of punishment which are very, very unusual. One is this incredibly high rate of sanctions, which is applied mainly to the young because the young are the majority of job-related benefit claimants. It's gone down since the million in 2013 in 1 year. In 2013, more money was raised in sanctions in England and Wales from people who'd failed to turn up to meetings and so on than all the fines imposed on every single criminal in England and Wales by every magistrate's court and every sheriff's court in Scotland. So that's an extreme to actually be taking away more money from people who are poor than you're taking away from people who've shoplifted and done anything else. I'm trying to give you a sense, I think, of how big it is. An equivalent for middle-class children is student loans. Because the average debt will be 52,000, and if you get a slightly good job, not as good as a junior researcher, but a slightly good job, your debt will be 100,000 for the middle class. Unless you're very upper middle class or lower upper class, in which case mum and dad will quietly pay the £9,000 each year and you'll have no debt. And we don't talk about that or study that. So let's wrap it up. I think we adapt very quickly to sudden changes, and we adapt also to slow changes, but I think we have to worry about how it affects what we study in our analysis. The Suez Crisis was a big change in British political thought in the 1950s. If you look at what social scientists researched before the Suez Crisis and after the Suez Crisis, it's after the Suez Crisis that we actually became a bit more concerned with how everybody did. There were a few mavericks beforehand, but the nature of the country and what it was okay to think and be changed dramatically after Suez. Before then, we were still a world power, we were an empire, we hadn't accepted that the US had knocked us off the top slot. Universities were full of scholars and gentlemen, and scholars were grammar school boys, and so on. After then, you get much more hard-headed analysis than we had before, and you get the Angry Young Men novels and other things. My view about Brexit for British research is it's going to be a bit like the Suez Crisis. We're suddenly going to discover that we're not going to be a great country. In fact, we're going to be a much poorer country. Not many years after the Suez Crisis, when Harold Wilson was Prime Minister in 1964, this was his Christmas card. It's Lowry's most optimistic painting. Lowry wasn't very good at producing optimistic paintings, but this is people ice skating in the northwest of England. And things got dramatically better. Wilson overfunded the 1971 census under Klaus Moser, so we got our best ever set of data and longitudinal study could set up. All after an absolute national mess. So if you want a sort of reason for optimism, I'd look back to then. But I do think we should be taking into account this rise in inequality in our cohort studies and not treating it as if we're studying an average place. The country that's become the most economically unequal in Europe isn't a normal place to be studying. Assuming it's had not much effect on the population doesn't seem to make much sense to me. We know what's happened to the health and the educational outcomes of people in the United States, and they've been very, very bad. And we're the nearest country to those. I won't say anything about economic growth, but that's the kind of model. We do talk quite a lot about social mobility and increasing equality of opportunity. But having a poor equality of an opportunity is an outcome. It's not a precursor. It's something you get from being a certain kind of country. Until last year, we had a Social Mobility and Child Poverty Commission. Now we only have a Social Mobility Commission, because the words child poverty have been taken out of its title. Cohort longitudinal studies are often used to try to say what kind of things could you tweak at the very start of life to give somebody a better chance. Whereas the right answer might be, this is not the playing field you want to end up with that you're throwing them into, because if it's this uneven, doesn't matter what you do earlier on. And my final slide. In hindsight, it's not surprising if there was going to be a country that found things difficult, the country which had been the richest on earth 100 years ago, and which then lost a large amount of its wealth, which was its empire, such as India and all those countries in Africa, which we never accepted was the way in which we became so rich. And so that when we became poorer, we blamed the trade unions in the 1970s, rather than realising that we'd lost a cash cow. And I think this affects us. I think it affects us in all kinds of ways. So we create booster samples in understanding society for ethnic minorities, which are minorities associated with immigration from that empire. And then are very surprised when the children of each of those groups does better than the people who are here already in terms of education, but are only doing the same as all migrant groups do, which is they do better. I think this has reached a point, the reason for doing the talk now, where it's very, very accelerated. So this is just going to be in the news for the next couple of years, and certainly the next couple of weeks. But we ought to step back and say, is there something about the society we're working and living in which is affecting our research and what we look at in ways that we may not have noticed because it changed so gradually at first and is now changing more quickly? Thank you very much.
Just in passing, you said that the government is just going to invest in longitudinal data now and forget about the rest. Well, most of the people in this room are actually very nervous about the ESRC's review on longitudinal studies that's going on at the moment, so from my parochial vested interest point of view, it would be great news if what you said was true, but I'm afraid it may not be. And now I'm going to do an advertisement for a blog that I wrote that came out last week about the findings of the Millennium Cohort, which I'm saying that this is an incredibly valuable document because it is charting the persistent, continuing degree of social inequality in this country in the 21st century. So if you were sort of hinting that these longitudinal studies are just somehow burying the bad news, I would say that they aren't, and that if you use these resources, if people use these resources, they will show tremendously how social inequalities pan out for individuals over time in a way that the standard cross-sectional data that ONS may not be allowed to have resources to go on producing anyway. There they are, and I don't think they are being used to apologise for the status quo. They can certainly be used to document what lies behind the sort of trends you're pointing to in the individual lives of the cohort members, and perhaps you can get some of your students to look into it some more.
Yeah.
I'd also like to say something about agreeing with you that we are not doing our children a service by measuring their success, so-called, in terms of exam results. But that was a question about other people.
Yeah. Thanks. I think I largely agree with your question and criticism. I love longitudinal study results. I have an enduring guilt that I've never actually gone and done any proper longitudinal work myself. But my worry is I haven't seen much work done, because it's so bloody hard, that compares the cohorts that grew up in a time, particularly the first one, in a time of dramatic increase in their quality for those born in 1946. The next cohort were a cohort brought up at least the first 20 years of their life in one of the most equal countries in Europe. Only Sweden, for large countries, was more equal. And then you get to the millennium cohort. I've skipped over at least one, which are growing up the most unequal. So you've got a country which has managed to have a natural experiment with people growing up in different contexts. And although you get some work that compares rates of social mobility, and then the economists argue with the education about how you measure it, and you never get much further, I haven't seen work that says this can be studied in this particular way, that would then fit with Gene Twenge's work in the States, which finds that the level of anxiety amongst children in the States now is incredibly high compared to children she's got data for in the 50s. But we largely agree. Shall I go to David?
Yes. If I just go back to your stuff on mortality, I think you were right to draw our attention to what's happening among older people. But I would like, my question concerns another group that seems to me a pressing concern, which, because in London at the moment, I don't know what it's like in the rest of the British Isles, but in London at the moment, there is an enormous increase in the number of homeless people sleeping on the streets this winter. And I remember in the Hilary Graham's Health Variation Programme, you did a project where you estimated the mortality rate of homeless people. Could you just remind us what roughly?
I think it was about, I think it was 44 years of age for men, and that was based on the average life expectancy of men found on the streets in London dead. And it had to be London, because in any other city, if you found a man dead, who was obviously homeless, he was taken to the nearest shelter, because there weren't many, so you knew which one he was supposed to be in. But London was so big, but it didn't. And there weren't enough women then who were homeless to work out a figure for women. It's shot up. Last couple of years it's shot up. This year in Oxford, for the first time, we've got people with entire possessions with them. At least half a dozen. Oxford's like a London borough. So half a dozen people between this train station and university with bedding and everything else from their home. And that's completely new. If you go to Manchester, university towns are good for this, Oxford Road, you'll see it. Leeds, I was in Leeds last week and I counted 80 people on Tuesday night and it was absolutely freezing, sleeping under the railway arches. But we've adapted, you know, it's
so
almost like...
The age of death of the homeless people in your estimate was 44 years.
About 44. I saw a figure recently, and it was remarkably similar, and I had a horrible feeling nobody's bothered to update it.
Yeah. I don't think anybody has.
Yeah. And we produced a figure for homeless shelters, which was much higher, I think in the 60s. Trying to affect shelters. The number of shelters is being cut. But it's like, probably, luckily we're all young enough now that nobody was in the war, even David. It's like, you know, in the war, people adapted month by month to there being a war, to there being bombing, to things happening, and got used to it. With the biggest financial crash, take you back to my very first slide, let me explain a little graph on that. Tiny little graph, that's GDP per head over time since 1950. You can't see the 70s, 80s, and 90s recession on that graph. But what has happened has been enormous, and it's been unfairly distributed. So since 2008-09, we have adapted to things being cut, to a quarter of hospitals saying they've got an emergency, to, you know, finding out that somebody died in Birmingham a month ago from freezing to death in the cold. We adapt very quickly, and this is partly what made me worry about what we do as researchers, because I can see myself becoming more callous over time, not being shocked by things that initially shocked me.
Thank you, it's really interesting. I was There's an email that went around last week from the Joseph Foundry Foundation, and I think we're talking about some work done that was, I think it might have been the IFS, but they found inequality had fallen a bit in general, but the 1% are going off. But everyone else has kind of become a bit more equal, things like the living wage policy, things like that.
Right.
I'm wondering how that relates maybe to, I mean, does it matter let the 1% speed away?
If we are, that's partly what I was talking about with this. But before this, for the 99%, we're now back to 1992 in terms of inequality. Andrew Neil, who always appears on politics shows, has a standard answer to inequality, which is, it's just a bit of few rich people in London, and if you take them out, we're a normal European country. In fact, it's fractal, so you have the same shape of inequality in the UK no matter where you look. Scotland is almost as unequal as England within every city. There used to be a competition between cities. People would say, I'm in the most unequal city. And it took us a long time to work out they all have a very similar slope from poor area to rich area within an unequal country. So just taking out the 1%, you're left with the same curve, same shape, but a lower start. The problem with the word becoming more equal thing is, so I'm in the 3%. I'm giving nothing away because the 3% is such a wide group, it's the entire professorial salary range of Britain, apart from a few clinical professors within the 2%. Right? I'm pretty well off, I'm in the 3%. I no longer get child benefit for 3 children. So that's how I've narrowed down slightly. Whereas one of the people who cleans the student bedrooms in my college gets an extra 20p an hour. Now, it isn't substantially, we haven't become that much closer together, but there has been this kind of narrowing in some way. The other thing is that when the IFS did that work, a lot of the benefit cuts haven't come through, and the IFS projections for the future are much worse than what they said. On the plus side, if we do suddenly get very high inflation and the pound dropping again to 20%, we really ought to get inflation. I don't know how else you manage to get goods into a country if they cost more without paying more for them. Inflation will actually reduce welfare inequalities dramatically. It just doesn't make people feel that good. Last answer to the question, still wondering why am I in the 3%? I'm in the 3% because by being in the 3%, I can just about buy a very, very small house in Oxford. That wasn't the case when I was growing up in the city of Oxford. I don't need to be paid my salary if we can only get housing costs down. Why can't we get housing costs down? Because the 2% and the 1% who are so much better off than me are paying more for the housing that I could otherwise live in. So the problem with the 1% is that they change the behaviour of the 2%, it changes the behaviour of the 3%, it changes the behaviour of the 4%, changes the behaviour of the 5%, and decide to buy a buy-to-let flat so that they've got a future and a pension, that then doubles the number of people in private renting who are all much worse off, because some other people are trying, and all they're trying to do as landlords is just keep up with a few consultants and university professors who moan about vice chancellors on £300,000 to £400,000, who say they're getting nothing because 3,000 bankers are getting a million, and it's far easier being a banker than being a vice chancellor. See, this is the problem with the stretch. But if you bring it down from top, look at a country like Germany, where there's only 190 bankers paid that much, and the behaviour is very different. Got another?
Last time I listened to one of your talks, you filmed that long ago, so by saying I'm feeling guilty about asking this, and I feel a bit the same this time, because I'm going to bring it back to research, and then Heather's first which is, I'm like Heather, not at all convinced by your suggestion that this crisis may in some way be, can do better work or get more research funding. I think if you cut KRI, there's even less chance, there's more chance that the research councils will be squeezed, but also what a lot of researchers don't seem to fully realise is the Royal Charter has been removed, and that means we're no longer independent, the research colleges are no longer dependent on government. And so not only do I think funds will be squeezed, I think there's a potential that government will interfere with the kinds of research that we can do, both in medical research, where I primarily work, and social research in the other areas. And the sort of difference between then and now goes back to your first point, that we're becoming more right-wing. So Harold Wilson was the one who sort of funded more of the tumours and they stopped with Margaret Thatcher. Because now we've got this much more right-wing government, and I don't see that going to change. I don't want to make everything a room feel pessimistic, but I think we have to recognise these things and keep an eye and challenge them as researchers.
Yeah. Now, I think I agree. I worry that as the BBC moves to the right, as the ONS moves to the right, almost as the Guardian moves to the right, we can do the same thing and not realise we're doing it. Or if you don't, you think, I'm really strange. You know, I'm worrying about the fact that there are more homeless people in the streets. You begin to think, is it me? Because everybody else seems to be stepping over them. The Royal Charter's gone, so we've got a civil servant now running the research councils.
But we've also lost our independence.
Yeah.
The in statute.
Yeah. But if you want worries, but also be optimistic, there is a potential banking crisis around the corner. London housing market, which I'm very happy about, with five boroughs have already gone, are going down. Most wealth in this country is in housing. The banks will fail their stress test if the house prices fall. The house prices have to fall because they're the highest in the world. There's a lot worse that could happen. The question is, particularly if you're younger, how do you build something out of that? This was built in the 1960s. You know, we got the 1960s out of a mess before that was austerity, old-fashioned, colonialist and stupid. And something very interesting came out of it, including comprehensive schools. What to do to think 5 to 10 to 15 years ahead to salvage things. And so it's describing work in a slightly different way, perhaps, and looking at outcomes in a slightly different way. So, you know, when you find out that the unemployed are not only just not fat, but thin, you know, on it, it's worth more of a Daily Mail story, Mail, not the Mirror, the Mail. You know, that there's a political reason why it's worth putting it out there, not just a paper in a high-ranking journal. But we've also become affected by this journal thing, you know, the US and the UK, and by the ranking of our institutions. And that's certainly changed our behaviour since 1992 when I first saw it.
So I suppose that was my question, because you articulate lots of anxiety and said, I'm really worried that I'm doing this and I'm not really aware of this and the other. What is it that you think we should be doing differently?
Telling people, if you find out that unemployed people are thinner than average rather than fatter, okay, it's a surprise, but tell people about it more, rather than, you know, slobs sitting around on the sofa while the hard working go out. Yeah, it surprised me. But it's just being a little bit more political, like social scientists, I think, were in the 60s and 70s. Now, maybe it's just the ones we remember were, and that's partly why we remember them, but I just think that I think it was more naughty, whereas now we're a bit more careful. About things, because we're in a society that's become more careful, because it's become more conservative. But I could be wrong. I'm expressing an anxiety because I'm trying to get a sense back. Go on. Do you make it last one? Are you getting into your time? Yeah, go on.
Oh, I just wanted to say you're not wrong, because I just finished revising my book on Harper Collier, which was written in basically the late 90s. And I thought, oh, great, you know, I can just update all the graphs. Well, you obviously are very familiar with trying to get data out of ONS. What's happened to all this data? Harper's an archive, you cannot get at it. If you want to get to the old wonderful journal Population Trends, as it used to be called, for anything before 1999, it's gone. And even from 1999 until Population Trend Demise, whatever that was, not so long ago, it changed its name. The only reason it's in an archive that you can access is because people like Peter Goldblatt fought, who was one of the central people in the original uncloning update. Can I update my data on going back to 1921 on health inequality in Britain? Not in any simple way. Actually, I have to tell you, the American statistical sources on health inequality, unfortunately, they don't have class. But if you want to do things on ethnic inequalities, on gender differences, they're much easier, I have to say. See these, what's called the Health of the United States, much easier to access. It's all open, not copyright, etc., etc. Do I want to update work on women's social roles? The nearest thing I can get at is Anne. Where are you, Anne? Yeah, you know, Anne Munns, the nearest person who's followed up classic work on women's social roles in health, but has had to move on to other things, so that kind of thing has not been updated. And the worst thing, which proves to me that what you're saying is something you do need to think about, the worst thing of all is that the latest big book on social epidemiology, the standard text edited collection by top scholars, has regressed from using the term socioeconomic position to refer to how we measure social inequality to the term socioeconomic status, which is basically a bunch of eugenics. And what's gone on along with that is many of the top people have diverted from doing brilliant research they did on health inequality when you and I were to doing research on genetics, and are now obliged to come out with statements like, oh, well, why did we get all this in the Daily Mail? And we've actually done this work, and it's got in the Daily Mail. There's the genetics associated with educational achievement and with social class. And then they come out and say, oh, by the way, it only explains 0.04% of the variation. And we now put ourselves forward to say, naughty, naughty. Okay, but they've done that research in the first place, and they continue and persist in doing that kind of research. It gets into the newspapers, and it's part of this coarsening of our attitudes towards inequality and social misfortune. So I think what you're saying, I don't see any particular answers to it, but I think what you're saying sums up a very important trend that I've seen in research that we in this room do.
Thank you. Am I okay for time?
There's actually a mistake in the time table, so it's fine, we can keep going.
Okay, sorry.
10 minutes.
I'm a GP in a number of researchers on the committee here. But it seems to me that there's an important question of the subjective ownership of people, and we in some ways talk about class ownership of a lot of this information. And I think that's an important thing for researchers to think about, which I know is something we've discussed in the presentations we've had here. Because this information is obviously is very important, not just to policymakers, but people throughout society who are suffering from this. And I think another area that's important is international collaborations. And giving your talk around Europe and comparison is extremely happening. We've, I suppose, also really seen this stuff in the press lately, but it's not just now, and it's not just in relation to social science research, it's in terms of how we look at our health service being organised, our education service, or everything. We do not, as a state, and I think that's not unique to Britain, have an international perspective. And I think that one of the ways that researchers can become stronger is making sure that these international collaborations are across the board and do include this kind of social science research, which is very much around agency and inequality.
I should be more aware than I am of terrible ignorance. There must be studies who've compared birth cohorts born at the same time in two countries. But I'm not very aware of them.
There aren't many. Well,
no,
we're the centre of birth cohorts, there aren't that many in the world.
And I also wonder whether international trade union sources of funding, for example, that might be interested in involving them, or other international collaborative organisations who might come on board.
Yeah. It's just that year of birth has such a massive effect on your life chances, not just health and education. Year is so important that if you're going to compare countries, you really want to compare people born in the same 12 months.
There's a former centre attached doctoral student who I worked in Paris called Lydia Panico, who is going together a cohort study comparison of growing up in Ireland, the Lenin cohort, and the health in France, and they're all about the same age. So
okay.
That might be a potentially useful comparison along the lines we've been discussing.
There are other studies doing that. There are studies that exist that can do that, but they're generally cohorts that are fairly recent, like the millennial cohort, like Alzheimer's, going back to the 90s. So you won't have many hard outcomes in terms of mortality, because even within sort of the cohorts are too small to have large amounts of mortality, to the larger Danish and Norwegian birth cohorts, but they're in similar countries, so it's not, so you're looking at proxy outcomes, but it is being done, as I can say.
Thanks.
Picking up on the point about collaborations, international collaborations, it just seemed, and you got a picture of the British Empire there at one point, and we do, well, there's also our fixation with the United States is pretty clear, and I think you were pointing that out as well, that basically we go, well, look, we've got to be more like this country, we've got to be more like this society, and when of course you see on your graphs, it was the big blob at the edge, and we're shaping ourselves to be more like that. We, you know, if you've ever been to an economics department,
yeah,
it's incredible. If they could put a flag with some stripes and some stars on it, they could have one flag, couldn't you? We can't have now sort of an interview where you don't know someone, you've got their CVs, you haven't. It's now a 2-day jamboree where they come to meet all the faculty, which is exactly what they do in the United States. You know, we're also aping that type of thing, and so I mean, that fits in. But again, the British Empire thing. A lot of the time when British American researchers are going out around the world, we're not going out there to learn from them. You know, you think of all some of the movements in South America going on, and we're not looking about how they're restructuring their health service, how inequality's been dealt with it. We usually go out in this sort of colonial thing of like, oh dear, the colonial doesn't know how to cure himself of disease, we're going to go out and show them how to integrate this program. I mean that would seem like a major change if we could start, I'm not personally involved with it, but a culture change in how we have lots to learn from the rest of the world, because if we just fixate on the current state of the way things are done, we'll just carry on doing them in the way we do. And that's the general comment. And the second general comment I wanted to make is just I was actually at this longitudinal review, which started going, the SRC's one last week, and I'll just corroborate what other people say, the general sort of background on this longitudinal review and the merger of the research councils into UCRI, it's fairly doom-laden, really, even though we're trying to say positive things about what the studies can do. But the thing about Andrew Dilnot gave sort of a little keynote for that, and he showed the wage distribution. He ran through, and they just had the distribution from 1962, and he ran through a little slideshow, and he got to about 1983, and the table started thickening, which is exactly the sort of, I hadn't heard of it, but in terms of fractals, it's a really nice way, whenever you put it, you always get these inequalities. And of course, he was going back in the 70s, that was nice, and it was like a normal distribution almost. Yeah, that's good. But of course, terrible economic performance. And I think one of the things we need, coming from my discipline as a statistician, is to rail against these single targets as useful descriptions of things. Because, GDP now, a country's got a high GDP, fantastic. There's no other debate. We're talking about the school performances. I think you have Singapore on your map, fantastic pizza stores, whatever. It's looking at multivariate outcomes. It's looking at, okay, the performance is good, but what about the suicide rate? What about the mental health? And I think, from my point of view, I think the thing we really need to start doing is stopping governments actually, you know, going and actively sort of saying, no, you cannot focus on a one-dimensional assumption of myriad dimensional problems. That's what I've learned. That's what I'm inspired from your talk.
Thank you. Yeah, you're making me worried about going out and... Well, the last country I went out to was Brazil, which is actually one of the few, you know, that is more unequal and more of a mess. But I didn't tell them what to do because I just apologised for where I was coming from. And they have some of the worst data in South America because it's hidden to actually find out how bad it is. And the irony in Brazil is that the children who are better off, a bit like the US, go to state-funded universities. Poorer, but obviously not the poor children, go to these private universities that cost a fortune and teach them nothing. You can see Blade Runner scenarios that are worse than where we currently are. And that worries me. So the last one.
Okay, if you're not feeling too exploited, I'll ask you a question. You're talking about people adapting after the crash, as if that's the big exposure. You know, going back to countries like Iceland, for example, the suicide rate was much higher before the crash. And so surely one of the exposures is actually the boom rather than the bust. The bust is a normalization in a sense, and the boom is the time of exposure for some people. The question is, who is this conspicuous consumption and inequality affecting? Is it the vice chancellor end, or is it the cleaner end?
Yeah. That's interesting. I mean, in the States and across Europe, the suicides peaked just before the crash. Partly, there were people in the finances who knew the crash was coming. You know, they were worried. And in Iceland, you know, people used to complain that they couldn't speak Icelandic. They had to speak English at the supermarket to the Polish workers. And now they can all speak Icelandic again. The change in lifestyle has been for the people who are in the top of the distribution. In the bottom quarter distribution, people are about 16% better off than their parents were. So it is that slightly bigger telly, and not so far back, but it's not much more. Children not sharing bedrooms. I think that's the kind of biggest change for most people. Whereas in the top end of distribution, it is 6 holidays a year. It is multiple computers that get far too integrated, but you can see the change. And it's largely because other people in the top 10-5% do the same thing. In education, I was at some high-up education meeting about 5 years ago, when a couple of vice-chancellors and the person running Hefke at the time all discussed whether they'd meet up for supper when they were in Tuscany in the most expensive week in August. So they really was sort of keeping up with the Joneses. And this is why the solution is relatively easy. It's a bloke called Robert Frank who wrote Success and Luck, a book recently. And he's a mainstream American economist. He wrote the main textbook with Ben Bernanke in the States. He's a very strange mainstream economist. And he tried to explain to Americans how being taxed was different to theft, because everybody else is taxed in your bracket, so you don't lose anything. And he explained it in terms of mooring his yacht, because his textbook had sold very well. He actually had a small yacht that he moored. And he said, as long as everybody who's done as well as me is taxed the same, all that happens is that the cost of our mooring reduces and we can still moor the yacht. Now you get to a point where you can't actually have a yacht, but as long as other people haven't got a yacht, you won't feel quite so bad. And this seems to me to be the thing, the argument we're not making. We're not explaining that you don't become much worse off as long as other people who've got as much as you drop down by the same. But we haven't studied it where it's happened. And the place it's happened is here. Between 1930s and 1970s, a huge reduction in the wealth of the best off. And people's lives improved, particularly people in the top. But where it didn't improve, and this is what worries me, is that for those at the very, very top, who used to run India, or like Enoch apparently wanted to, those people who used to run big sugar firms and so on, they and their grandchildren saw things getting worse. And I think we're being led by that small group whose grandparents, particularly grandfathers, were the masters of the universe in the 1920s and 30s. And they want it to be great again. And that's changing the argument for everybody else. You could halve all university professors' salaries as long as you halve the salaries of everybody else who's paid the same as them. Because, and it applies to London, the only reason people need a salary is housing. It's just got to that. It's not a car anymore, because you can't park a car here. The cars are relatively cheap. Food's relatively cheap. It's all about housing. And that's a very, very big change. Right. I should definitely stop now. Thank you very much.
Indeed.